Recorded Books presents Nona the Ninth by Tamsin Muir, narrated by Maura Quirk. Dedication for PT. Guest List, as transcribed by C. Hecht. Dogs to invite to birthday party. Brown one by the fish shop. Average sized, four legs. Stop It. Name assumed. Lies under counter at dairy. Red colour. Big sized. Four legs. White and black one seen once in the park. Average sized. Tail curled twice. Three legs. Noodle. King of dogs in secret. White adjacent. Small sized. Six legs. Spotted beach dog. Often on beach. Large sized. Huge ginger eyebrows. Three legs. Members of gang to invite to birthday party. Hot sauce. Honesty. Born in the morning. Beautiful ruby. Kevin. Teachers. The angel. Blood of Eden. Crown him with many crowns. Parentheses. No. C. End parentheses. The captain, maybe. Parentheses. Not possible. C. End parentheses. Cell commander, we suffer and we suffer. Although actually, she might be wing commander. I don't know which it is. Parentheses. It's both. And no. C. End parentheses. And you three. Parentheses. Good to know. C. End parentheses. One for the Emperor, first of us all. One for his lictors who answered the call. One for his saints who were chosen of old. One for his hands and the swords that they hold. Two is for discipline, heedless of trial. Three for the gleam of a jewel or a smile. Four for fidelity, facing ahead. Five for tradition and debts to the dead. Six for the truth over solace in lies. Seven for beauty that blossoms and dies. Eight for salvation no matter the cost. Nine for the tomb and for all that was lost. You told me, sleep, I'll wake you in the morning. I asked, what is morning? And you said, when everyone who fucked with me is dead. When everyone we loved has gone or fled, that's morning. Empty's just another word for clean. Let's put this first draft dream of mine to bed. In the appointed hour, I'll pull up your sheets. I'll kill the light, lie down beside you. Die, and sleep the night. This time will be the time we get it right. Forgiveness, not so hard, nor anger long. Our graves will be less deep, our lies less true. You held aloft the sword. I still love you. John 28. In the dream, he told her the words about where he took his degrees, his postdoc, his research fellowship. They were his noise and not really for consumption. More like meditation. Like even his mouth knew the pointlessness of it and just wanted to recite. Dilworth, Otago, Auckland, overseas to Corpus. She likes the word corpus. It sounds nice and fat. Then another year abroad, where he got the grant and met the men who would make things happen. Special pleading with the New Zealand government and Asia-Pacific Environmental at his suggestion. Then back to the facility outside Greytown. They mocked it up to look like a freezing works. We all thought that was funny, he said. He said, we just wanted to save you. You are so sick. He said, it was me and A and M at the start. It wasn't that they didn't have the money for a bigger team. We were simply the only ones capable of what they were asking. M for medical. A because he was the Glycerol 6 genius. He could have gone anywhere, but he stuck with me. And thank God for that, because he handled all the shareholders.
I was there for everything, but those meetings were like dying. I'll never love meetings. C was brought on by the oversight execs for contracts, you know, checks and balances, but look where that ended up. She was on our side before the first year was over.
He said,
"You have to understand that right up until that last year, we believed they were going to see it through. We knew the plan could work. The Markar cryocans had room for 11 billion people easy. We'd got the procedure down to 5 hours per person with a trained team of four. Assuming an existing medical degree, that training could take as little as weeks. Manpower wasn't an issue if we started now. Sure, the maternity stuff wasn't totally ironed out, but we were nearly there and the packing was perfect. Of course, they bitched about the timeline and they bitched about the money, but they were always going to bitch about the money. Our rule was nobody knowingly left behind."
He said, "Even when they were constructing the other ships, we got told straight up that it was nothing. They were being sent off to the Kuiper installation to be on point for the full population evac. IAF were involved. Pan-Euro Astronautics gave it their blessing. It was all so benign. We even lent them G at the time because they wanted to talk about coating. M said that she didn't like it. She smelled a rat. And you know what I said? You know what I told her? I said, don't let it get to you. And I said, don't get paranoid. I fucking looked her in the eye and said, this is the way we're getting out. And you know that the moment half a dozen trillionaires realize it, they're going where the oxygen is. That's what I always told her. They're going where the oxygen is. Wealthy men head for the exit."
He said, "When they called me up and said the cryo project was over, she looked at me and she just said, there they go, John."
In the dream, they were sitting on the beach. He had made a fire from damp driftwood. The smoke made a black mark where it touched the tarpaulin, at the top where it was stretched over their heads. The ash was still falling. It made them sick, but only ever for a little while. Anything that hurt them only ever hurt them for a little while. In the dream, she was sat next to a bundle of meat he'd cut, thighs mostly, for when they felt hungry, which happened rarely and always simultaneously. When it did happen, they would be side by side, eating until their stomachs were sore. They would drink from the sea like dogs. He said, after a pause,
"You know the worst part? She cried. She and A both cried, in each other's arms like babies. They were so fucking scared. And I was right there and I couldn't do piss. Everything I was and everything I had done, and I couldn't do a damned thing."
He was quiet for a long time. The sea ate at the sand. The waves glowed a little, even though there was no sunshine, only thick yellow cloud. She prompted, "So what did you do?"
He said, "A damned thing, didn't I?"
She said, "When is the part where you hurt me?" He said,
"Soon. It's coming up."
She said, "I still love you." And in the dream, he rubbed his temple with his thumb and said,
"You always say that, Harrow Hark."
Day one.
Regarding Nona, Hot Sauce is watchful. The city has a bad day. Nona gets a bedtime story. 5 days until the tomb opens.
1.
Late in the year of nobody she really thought about that much in particular, the person who looked after her pushed the button on the recorder and said, "Start." She squeezed her eyes shut and began in a practiced hurry. "The painted face is on top of me. I'm in the safe water. I'm lying down, I think. Something's pushing at me. The water goes over my head and it's in my mouth.
It goes up my nose.
Does it hurt?
No.
How do you feel?
I like it. I like the water. I like her hands.
Her hands?
They're the things around me. Maybe they're my hands.
The pencil scratched loudly on the paper. How about the face?
It's the picture face.
The sketch they'd made for her. The one locked in the secret drawer where they put all the really interesting things, like cigarettes and the fake identification cards and all the money they said wasn't legal tender and couldn't be used. The pencil obligingly scribbled its way across the page. It was hard not to open her eyes and look at the person opposite, so she amused herself by imagining what she would see. Tanned, sure hands on the notebook, head bent over it, the fringe pinned up, waiting for haircut day. Imagining was better than looking anyway, because the battery lamp wasn't switched on. She said, "What are you writing?" Because the pencil was still going. Most of the time the writing was interesting, but some of the time it was just boring descriptions of how her face was changing when she talked, like 0.24, smiled. Incidentals. Keep going. You woke up late.
Can you change the alarm song? I can sleep through good morning now.
Sure. I'll drop a wet sponge on your face instead. Keep thinking. She kept thinking.
The arms go really tight around me.
They're her arms, definitely. Is she familiar?
Maybe. I don't know.
How do you know they're her?
I don't know.
What happens after that?
Don't know.
A long pause. Anything else?
No, it's gone already. Sorry, Camilla.
Not a problem. Camilla Hecht depressed the button with the bright and final plastic clack. This was the cue, so she exploded into action. The rule was that she had to lie still and concentrate as hard as she could from the time that the button went down to the time when the button went up. When it went up, pajamas came off. Under the pale, wavering light of the tiny torch taped to Cam's clipboard, she undressed and dressed herself at the same time, which required a lot of contortions. She wrestled out of her nightshirt with her arms and stretched on her trousers using her ankles in the move that Camilla called worm with problems. Being the worm with problems did not worry her. Just being able to dress herself was charming. In the bad old days, she used to have to be helped, even with the nightshirt, because she couldn't be trusted not to get stuck with it halfway over her head and get all hot and upset from claustrophobia. It was incredibly important that she not get upset like that again. She had only ever had two tantrums in her life, but it would be humiliating to have a third. Her fingers fumbled a little with the vest, but she was fine pulling on the UV sand shirt, even with arranging the cuffs, which could be complicated, and if you got it wrong, you had to stand in the bath to take it off again in showers of yellow dirt. The canvas jacket, with the toggle closers, didn't slow her down at all. When she finished, Cam said, "Good, quick," and she was so exhausted from the praise she collapsed back on the mattress.
"I'm doing my stretches now,"
she announced hastily, before she could be told to do anything else. She swung her legs upward until her feet were pointed flat at the ceiling, and, as she'd been taught, rotated her toes from that angle to circle around the water stain she could see on the plaster. The winter wet was over, but the huge patch of black damp in the corner hadn't dried up yet. She had told everyone that she should really talk to the landlord, but it had been communicated to her that if she could even find the landlord, she would get a gold medal. Camilla had not said anything in approval or censure, so she said more emphatically,
"My legs are really tight today," in the immortal hope that Cam would take her ankles in her hands and walk them forward.
Cam would do this until her knees were touching her chest and her hamstrings were stretched so taut she was convinced they were about to go ping and snap. It was the best thing in the world. If she was really lucky, Camilla would rub her calves, which were always sore from walking, or even sometimes her back, though that was usually after practice. But Camilla was busy writing and did not take the bait, no matter how much she wiggled her toes. She even repeated herself and added, "Wow! Very tight! Goodness gracious!" in a slightly louder voice. Cam said, not looking, "Walk it off." "I think I might have a cramp. I think I can't move."
"Guess she can't go to school then."
She knew when she was beaten. "I'm up! I'm up!" To prove how up she was, she arched her back and rocked up to stand, having only pushed herself up a little bit with her arms. She'd been practicing, and when she straightened up with only the slightest wobble, she was delighted. But all Camilla said was, "Don't hyperextend," crushingly, and worse, "go see if Pyrrha needs help with breakfast."
"Okay. She's probably done, though. It took forever. Maybe the food went cold," she added, misty with desire.
Camilla briefly looked up from the notebook with a critical eye at her bedhead, which had not been improved with stretches or jumping, and she added, "Get her to do your hair. I'm going to talk."
"Oh, good. I'll time."
"I've got a clockwork."
"Cam, that sounds strange. Nobody here calls it a clockwork. They say watch."
"Good to know. Stop trying to miss breakfast." She hedged cunningly.
"At least please can you write down, 'I love you, Palamedes.' Please? From me? At least write, 'I love you, Palamedes,' from Nona."
This Camilla Hecht did unblushingly, though Nona had to take it on trust. When she squatted down on her haunches, following the strokes the pencil made, she could not make out a single word. She could not even make out a letter, not of any alphabet she'd ever been shown, which interested everyone except herself. But you could always trust Cam. When the pencil stopped and the message was obviously discharged, Nona leant into her and said,
"Thanks. I love you too, Camilla. And do you know who I am yet?"
"Someone who's late for breakfast," said Camilla.
But as Nona straightened, she turned and smiled her rare brief smile, the one like the sun catching the glitter of a car on the motorway. Cam smiled so seldom now that Nona immediately felt it was going to be a good day. It wasn't any lighter in the kitchen. There was thin blue light coming through the joins in the curtains and an orange glow from the worn-out hot plate, mostly blocked by the other person she lived with. There was a baby wailing in mourning-related outrage a few apartments away, so Nona walked on the balls of her feet to not add to the noise. The people underneath hated it if you walked loudly, and Pyrrha said they had militia links and not to piss them off because they were also hungover 90% of the time. This was unfair because the person above them never took their shoes off inside, which surely meant they were allowed to complain about that. But Pyrrha said they shouldn't piss them off because they were a cop. Pyrrha called it the shit sandwich. Pyrrha always seemed to know everything about everybody.
"All done?"
"Good timing," said Pyrrha, without turning around.
Pyrrha was holding a can of spray-on oil, whose nozzle she directed neatly into the pan, where she wiped the pale froth around with a spatula. She was wearing pyjama pants and a string vest and no shirt, so the orange glow of the hot plate ring lit up all the scars on her wiry arms. She was feeling around for the breakfast things in the cupboard with her other hand, so Nona came and took the mesh basket and started counting out plates for her.
"Is that pikelet mix?" she said.
"Get bowls. It's eggs," said Pyrrha.
Up close, Nona could smell the spray-on oil and watch Pyrrha agitate a fork in a beaker of violently orange liquid, radioactively orange even in the dark, before tipping it into the pan to sizzle. Yellow lacework immediately formed where it splashed against the hot edge. Nona replaced the plates with two chipped bowls, and Pyrrha said,
"Doesn't that school of yours teach counting?"
"Oh, but Pyrrha is so hot.
Can't I have something cold?
Sure. Leave them to get cold.
Yuck, that's not what I meant.
The eggs aren't optional, kiddie. How's the dreams?
Same as normal, said Nona, reluctantly taking another bowl. I wish I could dream something different for once. Do you dream, Pyrrha?
Sure. Just last night I dreamed I had to give a briefing, but I wasn't wearing pants and my backside was hanging out, said Pyrrha, hacking the shocking orange curds into clumps with the edge of the spatula. During a pause in Nona's gurgles of mirth, she added solemnly,
It was no fun, my child. I knew I'd be okay so long as I was hiding behind the podium, but I didn't know what I'd do once I had to sit down again. Die, I guess.
Are you being serious or joking with me? Nona demanded, once this fresh pleasure had subsided.
Deadly serious. But go put another mark under ass joke anyway.
Nona was happy enough to get up from the table and cross to the big sheet of brown paper tacked up on the wall, to take the pencil and wait for Pyrrha to say,
One higher, one left, stop, right there,
so she could make a blobby tally mark. She counted up the tally marks and said,
That's the 7th one this month. But that's not fair when you keep making them. Palamedes will say you're skewing the data.
I never could help giving the girls what they wanted, said Pyrrha.
She turned off the hob and upended some of the pan into Nona's bowl, then set the pan back on the hob with a cloth over it to keep it warm. She wiped her hands and said,
Eat. I'll do your hair.
Thank you, said Nona, grateful for the understanding. Cam said to ask, Can I get braids?
Whatever the lady wishes.
Can I get one big braid and two little braids coming off it at the sides?
Sure, if we've got time.
They don't come loose and the plain plaits do, Nona added in the spirit of truth. And I can't help chewing the ends with plaits. I want to steer clear of temptation.
Don't we all? I need to stop torturing myself by staring at the cigarette drawer.
Don't start the second-hand smoke argument again, said Nona, in alarm, but then, figuring she'd been harsh. Anyway, they're bad for you, and I love you, Pyrrha.
Prove it, said Pyrrha, which meant she had to eat the eggs.
Nona ate while Pyrrha brushed out her hair in short, brisk strokes, letting its fine black sheets fall over Nona's shoulders. It went almost to the bottom of her back now, and it was soft and thin as water. Every fourth haircut day they cut it. But not every haircut day, because it was a pain, and because people noticed your hair growing less when it was already long, Camilla said. Camilla and Pyrrha both got to have short hair, which she envied. Cam's was dark brown and bobbed off sharply at the chin, and it felt nice against your cheek. And whenever Pyrrha didn't shave her head quick enough, she got a little flat cap of dark terracotta, the colour of wet red earth at the building site. Most of Pyrrha was the colours of the building site. Deep, dried-out browns, dusty hunks of clay, rusted metal. She was raw and ropey and square-shouldered, and Camilla was long and shadowy and lean. Nona thought they were both exquisite. Camilla came in when Pyrrha was fixing up the first braid and when Nona had gotten as far as chewing the eggs, which was an agonising step on the journey to eating the eggs. Camilla said unhappily,
Eggs! Have we not invented a new protein?
Which meant it wasn't Camilla at all. The easiest way of telling who was who was in the eyes. Palamedes had soft, cool eyes of brownish grey, like bare ground in the cold mornings when Nona had been little, and Camilla had the clearest of clear grey eyes, like storybook ice, not like normal cloudy ice at all. But Nona could tell them apart from across the room, which she was proud of, because their body was otherwise exactly the same. The difference was how they stood. Camilla couldn't stand still ever, not without shifting her weight back and forth on each knee or popping her knuckles,
and Palamedes stood like he was playing a game of hot chocolate, and the tagger was looking right at him. Hot chocolate was in fashion with her friends at the moment, and Nona wanted to get really good at it.
"Meat's black market only right now," Pyrrha said, starting in on a second braid.
Palamedes was spooning gritty black spoonfuls of instant coffee into mugs. He said absently,
"Coffee, Nona?"
even though she always said, "No, but thank you." Palamedes liked giving you options, and he even waited until she said, "No, but thank you," before he poured the boiling water twice. No milk, because they'd run out of packets. He put one mug where Pyrrha could reach it. She was currently leaning over to the counter for a hairpin, and kept one for himself. They sat and steamed in the muggy air, and Nona sniffed at the nice bitter coffee smell. Pyrrha continued,
"Anyway, you're paying for the meat roulette. The stuff the butcher's keeping back is only 10% upholstery. The rest is livers and gristle."
Nona wanted to know,
"What part's the upholstery?"
"A very nutritious part," said Palamedes.
"The part that hung out in my dream," said Pyrrha. That set Nona off again, so she had to get up from her eggs to make another mark on her tally sheet. Palamedes stared, distracted, and said,
"Dear God, two in a day. Why are we even remotely in doubt? Forget the meat, I was being facetious. We wouldn't have upholstery money even if I wrote hardcore pornography for a living."
Pyrrha said,
"Wish you'd try. These nicotine patches are killing me."
"If that's meant to make me feel guilty, I feel nothing, thank you," said Palamedes.
"Cam's body is a temple. She's the one who's banned me from a life of peddling poor quality erotica. Says she doesn't want our last gift to the universe to be tales of people mashing birthday cakes beneath their bottoms. Speaking of, Pyrrha, do you have a minute? You came in too late last night to talk."
"We're overtime, is why," said Pyrrha. "The damn drills stop every half hour so we can take cover."
Nona felt the pin securing the last little braid to her head, and then the braid being patted flat with one weathered hand. Pyrrha said,
"Empty that bowl, Nona,"
and took her mug of coffee as Palamedes spooned himself some eggs. She and Palamedes went back into the bedroom with their breakfasts and closed the door behind them. In their absence, Nona considered the eggs. They were a uniform yellow colour, with dusty black flecks of pepper. You were allowed to put as much thin, fiery red sauce on them as you liked, but it wasn't the taste, Nona minded. She then considered the window beyond the curtains, which was open a crack, at the very least enough for a spoon. Pyrrha had, after all, said to empty the bowl, but Palamedes said that she could handle abstract concepts, and therefore literal interpretation was not a defence. She considered the eggs again. As a virtuous compromise, she put three spoonfuls in her mouth and walked soundlessly over to the shut door. It was unnecessarily harsh to expect her not to listen and to eat.
"Overdue for a chat about the due date," Pyrrha was saying. "If they want her early, want can be their master. They gave us a year."
Then they both moved away from the door, which made things more difficult.
"Anything from your side?"
Palamedes was speaking at the bottom of Camilla's voice.
"Saying some guys to come over Site B. Push maybe tomorrow, we promise in Site C. We know they own the build. Save sites first. The closer we get to the barracks, to being rumbled that we're searching."
There was more talking, but they had both dropped their voices past Nona's comprehension, so it sounded like, "Mene, mene, mene." She held the eggs in her mouth silently and pressed her ear to the door as hard as she dared, and was rewarded with Palamedes saying,
"Could have made inroads on the barracks at any point. They're holding off. Why?"
"You know why," murmured Pyrrha's voice in response. The moment they go in there and clean out the last poor bastards busy divvying up the rats and the sedatives, that's going to put a big black mark on the negotiations. The cohort dies like anyone else under siege. Eventually. Then this is our last chance to make a difference. Give us orders, Commander.
Pyrrha was audibly chewing.
Stopped being that when I died, Palamedes. It was a courtesy title anyway, and there's an embarrassment of commanders here if you want 'em.
Pyrrha, he said, why are they running now? Why would Blood of Eden run when they have the best hand they were ever dealt? Why would they run when common sense, good tactics and foreknowledge must tell them all that this is the best moment to make a stand? The time you've spent, the insights you've had that nobody else has been privy to, and you're truly telling me you don't even have an inkling.
You're not a prude. Feel free to say it, said Pyrrha, and though her voice was its normal, deep, comfy, slightly hoarse self, there was a little undercurrent in it that Nona couldn't quite pass. Nona would have understood it more if only she'd been able to see Pyrrha. I spent all that time sleeping with the enemy with very little to show for it, right? Blood of Eden is a house with many rooms, and I was only ever visiting one of them. Sure, I've got inklings aplenty.
Then you've got to brief us.
He was cut off by a metal-on-plastic noise, like eggs being spooned from the bottom of the bowl.
No, not if there's any risk of you two undergoing interrogation. Neither of us appreciate being treated like children.
Children?
I'm treating you like the Sixth House Warden and his cavalier, neither of whom have been trained to survive a Blood of Eden hot seat, said Pyrrha. Don't think because Camilla's carrying you that you'd have an easy ride. You have no idea what BOV torture is like, and we don't have the 5 years I'd need to teach you.
Pyrrha, stop saying you don't have time to teach us things and start teaching. We're quick studies.
There was a definite slurp of coffee being drunk. Pyrrha always did drink loudly. She said she still wasn't used to her teeth.
I could teach you some bits and pieces, sure. I'd need my necromancer to teach Camilla.
Why?
Because you need teaching to be an asset, and Cam wants teaching to be a killer.
There was a brief silence, until Pyrrha said slowly,
or you could take me up on my first offer, which would solve a lot of your problems.
Palamedes spoke at the bottom of Cam's voice, which made it harder to catch.
It was a beautiful offer, Pyrrha, and almost completely useless. There's no retiring our forces in a search and recovery op. In any case, Eden would turn on us completely, even our own cell. We need to fight clever.
If you wanted to fight clever, you'd focus on search and recovery and not on the barracks.
It's not helping, Cam. She's mad as hell, even madder than you, and it's getting you nowhere.
Thank you for your insight regarding my cavalier, said Palamedes politely. It's appreciated.
A snort of laughter. He ices over. I'm too old to know not to be offensive, Palamedes, so forgive me quickly for telling you your business and let's move on. I'll say it outright. Forget the barracks and stop trying to be the people's hero. We've lost that fight.
Lost? There could still be 200 people holed up in there.
Optimistic.
If there were two, I'd do it. It's a rotten way to die, house or not. What's more, once it's over, the deluge.
Hey, we might get some breathing space. It might drain the boil.
You can't truly believe that.
No, I don't. It'll be first blood, said Pyrrha, and made another slurp. I know how it is. You should have heard the demo crew yesterday. These people are beside themselves waiting for kickoff, waiting for the houses. One guy tells me this'll all be over once the barracks get cleaned out,
Another guy tells me he'd welcome the cohort regiment with open arms if they just brought supplies and broke up the gangs. Half my guys would strangle the other half on a pretext. This is what happens when you force refugees from 20 different planets to live cheek by jowl, and you keep thinking people unify under a common threat. She always made that mistake. I told her 20 years ago. Works beautiful in the short term, but you've got to give them a future to really keep them glued. Palamedes, we made this mistake ourselves. You can have the barracks or your people, or neither. You can't say, I choose both like a wet towel and expect the universe to fall into line.
Pyrrha, this is sounding perilously like giving up.
Does it? You know I'm ready to give up. This is a shit show. You know I'm ready to get Nona safely off-world the moment you accept the way things are. There's no way off-world. It's called a ship. If you're hiding a ship in your dungarees, please share it with the rest of the class. His voice now raised a little. Bypassing the question of how, where would we go, Pyrrha? What would we do?
Anywhere, she said. Anything.
I've been out of commission for 10,000 years. I'm ready for pretty much anything else.
There was a brief silence, then a slurp. When Palamedes picked up again, his voice was earnest.
It's a false dichotomy, you know. We're all of us in one layered hostage situation. 3 million people squatting on a Thanagy planetoid millions of kilometers away from us. 9 million people in this city alone, who aren't yours by any stretch of the imagination. 9 million, Pyrrha. That's equivalent to the whole of the 7th and the 8th put together. 3 million people plus 9 million people plus 16. We refuse to leave any of them behind.
You're big-minded. Know who isn't?
Blood of Eden. And me, said Pyrrha.
If you asked me to pick between the three of us and those 12 million plus 16, I'd pick us without turning a hair.
You're not listening to me.
B of E are making that choice, Palamedes. We suffers lost. The Wakers and Tessaphon Wing can't protect us. Merv Wing's got the glue, which is a way out. The Hopers call the shots now, and I've met leaders like Unjust Hope before. They're the guys who come to the fore when people want leaders who don't count the costs. We're heading for a purge, Sextus. This is the Blood of Eden who don't give a fuck.
I wouldn't have called them too generous with fucks before.
You've got no idea. Listen to me. You've never met this Blood of Eden. Not really. This Blood of Eden has spent their entire existence gambling everything on staying alive for one more day. And I don't know if I even want to find out why anymore. 'Cause you know what? Gideon's dead. And I don't give a fuck either. Not if I can save our skins.
I don't believe you.
You should. I know a little moon that's only half flipped. It's got great soil, breathable air. Gideon used to think about running away there. I know how to farm. I can teach you and Cam and Nona. I can teach you how to wait. That's my speciality. And the moment I get my hands on a ship, that's where I'm taking us.
There was another rustling. But then the timer bleated in a soft, muffled way, as though it was coming from inside a pocket. Palamedes made a sound under his breath that Nona knew was a rude word. He said quickly,
My time's up.
That's the best part, right? Getting out of rough conversations.
And almost immediately, more quietly,
Forgive me the joke, Warden. I forget you're not used to it.
Never will be. You understand.
Look, you'll be late for work and Nona will be late for school.
Pyrrha's voice dropped, so that the only thing Nona caught was,
"In her go too.
I want her to remain as calm as possible. Can you push for Site B?
I'll do it by end of day, even if I have to finish it off myself. Don't worry."
Nona looked at the last lumps of yellow in her bowl and silently scraped half of it up to put in her mouth, figuring that if she swallowed all at once, she wouldn't choke or taste. She could not have made the slightest sound, but Camilla, she could tell it was Camilla again, called from within.
"How long were you listening, Nona?"
"You were pretty loud, so nearly the whole time," said Nona, through eggs.
"Then that damn breakfast had better be eaten," said Pyrrha.
Camilla stood by the kitchen counter and tore through her half-eaten breakfast mechanically as Nona unwrapped a sterile tablet in the bucket of grey water for the dishes. Pyrrha balanced a mirror on the table and shaved her face. Nona loved the clean, bright smell of shaving soap, and to see Pyrrha swiftly and expertly scrape the dark, russet-brown stubble off her cheeks and from around her mouth, and the little wet red marks that appeared. When she reached over to touch one freshly smooth cheek, the marks were already wrinkling up and disappearing. Cam was stationed by the pegs at the door, saying,
"Hats!"
prompting Nona to dutifully take down and hand round the hats, and
"masks" for the same.
The hats were hideous, large-brimmed with cloth panels that came down behind and strings to tie beneath the chin. Nona often thought about burning hers, and it wasn't as though they needed either hats or masks. That was the whole problem, wasn't it? Nona wouldn't cough even if the wind blew the smoke straight into her face, and Pyrrha wouldn't burn any colour other than her deep, cool brown. Camilla was busy untucking the black veil on her hat, so Nona let her attention drift to the side of the window, where light was thickly glowing through the little rips in the tape, and the sky was visible through the worst tears. The sky over the city used to be a thick yellow butterscotch colour. Now it was only like that at the very edges of the horizon, as the blueness had spread like a stain on carpet, touching even the light. Nona took a moment to surreptitiously twitch the curtains, peeking between the broken anti-sniper striping to catch a glimpse of the world outside. The blue light got stronger, and Camilla said sharply,
"Nona!"
And she hurriedly let the curtains fall. Pyrrha, now masked, paused before the door with her wiry knuckles.
"Roll call. What's this week's all scatter word?"
"Lowdown," said Camilla.
"And the all clear?"
"Dead weight," said Nona.
"Perfect. What are your stations if that thing in the sky even looks like it's about to stop periscoping?"
"The underground tunnels by the fish market," said Camilla.
"The big underpass bridge dugout," said Nona.
10 points to you both. And what do you do once you're there?"
"Hide until you come," said Nona, and then added truthfully, "and rescue any nearby animals so long as they don't exceed the size of the box and are woolly rather than hairy."
"Half points. No animals hairy or woolly. I don't care. Kim?"
Camilla had finished with her hat, and now she was easing the big dark glasses onto her face, the ones she kept specially, despite the fact that they were a little unbalanced on her nose and her ears. They made both Palamedes and Camilla look chilly and clinical, but as Palamedes said, they solved the problem of the ghost limb. Without them, he was everlastingly pushing something up his nose that wasn't there, and Nona thought Camilla privately rather liked them. She settled them on, considered the question, and said,
"Fight." "No points, Camilla. If you engage with a herald, you're not coming home."
"That's your theory," said Camilla.
"There's data behind it, Hecht."
"If Camilla gets to fight, I should get to keep adjacent dogs," said Nona decidedly, "even if they're hairy."
Pyrrha turned her eyes up to the ceiling in mute appeal. Her exhalation rasped loudly against the vent in her mask.
I used to run the whole bureau, she said,
and she didn't sound like she was addressing either of them.
Now I'm up against wannabe heroes and hairy dogs. This is the punishment she would have wanted for me. God, she must be pissing herself laughing. Let's go, kids. Like hell am I walking in this heat.
2.
Pyrrha worked for Nona. Camilla looked after Nona, and Palamedes taught Nona, all on the understanding that she was not simply a person, but probably one of two people. Nona did not know either of her real possible names. Palamedes said not to lead her unnecessarily. One of the reasons they had called her Nona was that the first thing she had said when they saved her and brought her here was, "No, no!" No-no became Nona, and Nona meant nine, and nine was an important number. What she definitely knew was that her body belonged to one of two people, and she was interested in her body. When she looked in the mirror, she had skin the colour of the egg carton, and eyes the colour of the egg mixture, and hair the colour of the burnt-out bottom of the pan. More to the point, Nona thought she was gorgeous. She had a thin, complicated face, and a mouth too easily unhappy and too easily discontented. But she had nice white teeth and a smile that looked sad no matter how happy she was, and arched black brows, like she always wanted to ask someone a question. Nona talked to herself in the mirror even now. When she had been earlier born and less self-conscious, sometimes she would rest her face against the mirror's face and try to reach her reflection. Camilla had caught her kissing it once and had written about 6 pages of notes on that, which was humiliating. It was hard enough not to be allowed a single solitary secret without a book being written about whatever you did. If Camilla had 6 pages of notes on her kissing herself, she had about 20 regarding eyes. Nona's egg-yellow eyes belonged to the other person, the other girl. That was how all of their bodies worked, not only hers. All 4 pairs of their eyes belonged to other people. Pyrrha's deep brown eyes really came from her dead best friend, and Camilla's clear grey eyes should have really been Palamedes's, and vice versa with his wintertime irises. Nona's eyes were a deep, warm gold, the colour of the sky at midday, or at least the colour the sky had used to be at midday. "You see," Palamedes had said to her, "the eyes are a dead giveaway. When you give yourself to someone else, their soul shows in yours by the eye colour. That's why you'll never see me looking out of Camilla's face with my own eyes again."
"So, someone's inside me, then? I mean, I'm that somebody?"
She always stumbled over this. "Maybe yes, Nona, maybe no. Eyes can also show that a soul is in somebody else's body temporarily. Your amber eyes could mean that you're like Camilla and me, or it could mean something else.
But you seem to have had
a big shock."
"Maybe I've just lost my memory," said Nona dubiously.
"It happens," agreed Palamedes, not convinced. She didn't care whose eyes were whose, but she was a little vain and cared about being nice-looking. Nona knew early that other people thought she was pretty too. Once, a long time ago, when she was waiting in line to pick up some detergent and Camilla was getting something else they'd forgotten, the person in the line behind her had said,
"Hi, pretty thing, where have you been all my life?"
and laughed a lot when Nona said truthfully that she didn't know. Then they had stood quite close to her and touched her on the hip, where her shirt was tucked in. The shop was very crowded, and there were a lot of people waiting to get things, and the aisles were packed high with stuff, and there were people the shop paid to make sure nobody stole things, and they added to the crowd. Nobody was paying them any attention. When Camilla came back, the person was still trying to talk to her, and Nona had to translate what they said to Camilla, and Camilla,
looked the person deep in their eyes and casually touched the hilt of the knife she kept down the waistband of her trousers, and then the person moved to the back of the queue. "If someone touches you again, and it's not me, and it's not Palamedes, and it's not Pyrrha," Camilla had told her later, "move away. Get one of us. You don't know what they want."
"They wanted to see me naked," said Nona. "It was a sex thing."
Camilla had made a sound, and then pretended it was a cough, and drank a whole glass of water. After the glass of water, she said, "How did you know?"
"That's just the way people look when they want to see you naked, and it's a sex thing," said Nona. "I don't really mind."
After a moment, Camilla had told her it wasn't a great idea for Nona to let people she didn't know see her naked, and not to encourage sex things. She said sex things were right out. She said there were enough problems in the world. Camilla said it was bad enough that she had used to help Nona in the bath. Camilla had also written down a lot more notes. That was after Nona could talk, but before she started making herself a useful member of society. It was difficult living with Pyrrha and Palamedes and Camilla in those early days, and feeling as though she couldn't contribute much. They worked so hard for her. Pyrrha was an excellent planner and good with her hands, and if you gave her 5 seconds to talk, she could make anyone believe anything. So they ate quite a lot off the money she won at cards. She ran them all with what Cam said was military efficiency. Pyrrha was the one who made them learn code words for all clear and danger, which changed every week. Nona got to be the one who picked them on weekends, because that helped her to remember. Pyrrha also gave them special emergency code words for someone following, red ribbon, and someone listening, fritters. They even had a code word for important resource, come help me get it, fishhook. But Palamedes said Pyrrha needed to stop treating cigarettes and liquor as important resources, so they hadn't used that one in ages. Pyrrha could cook, and she was tough, and if you went up to the roof of the apartment building and put a marble on top of a certain column, she could close her eyes and raise a rifle and shoot the marble from the other side of the rooftop. She wouldn't do this lately, even if Nona asked, because bullets were expensive right now, but a lot cheaper than meat. So Pyrrha could earn money and fight with a gun. She was also very wonderful with a sword, but she never lifted a sword unless all the curtains were drawn and the door was locked. They hid the swords behind a false board in the cupboard. Camilla could fight with pretty much anything, and especially knives. She wouldn't do the marble trick with her knife because she would just say, "What did it do to me?" and then smile her tiny, beautiful smile. Palamedes said that was typical. It seemed like there was nothing Camilla couldn't do after a few tries. The laundry, or starting up a truck, or opening a door when she didn't have the keys, or telling the drunk man at the bottom of their hall that none of them liked it when he hit his partner in a mystical way that caused the man to move out of the apartment forever. Palamedes could think. He said it was his party trick. But Nona couldn't shoot or fight or think. All she had was a good nature. That wasn't true all the time, but Nona didn't want it bruited about that she had a bad temper when she had only ever thrown 2 tantrums in her life and couldn't remember either of them. Even if she'd been proud of those, you couldn't brag about 2 tantrums. Every day she held a sword until she seriously didn't care about swords anymore, but she still couldn't fight with one, no matter how big or thin it was. Camilla had wanted to teach her properly, but Pyrrha said not to, that they wouldn't be able to tell if anything suddenly came back. Nona couldn't do the forbidden bone tricks either, even though Palamedes did nearly the exact same thing with big grey lumps of bone as Camilla did with the sword. She had to hold them and listen when he told her to do nonsensical things. "Pretend you can stretch it. Stretch it now." Or, "Pretend you can touch the insides. Split it open."
He never made Nona feel bad for not being able to do any of these things, only acted like it was interesting that she couldn't. In the beginning, she hadn't been able to do much for herself at all, but over time she had remembered how to button her shirts and tie up her laces and soap herself in the bath and pour water into a glass so that her hand didn't tremble and the water didn't slop out. It shamed her, remembering how little she could do at the start. She had been so frustrated in those slow early days, but now she could do nearly everything. She knew important facts like what was expected and what was unexpected at different parts of the day, and that people's ears weren't so interesting that she had to put her fingers inside them. In those early days, Palamedes and Camilla and Pyrrha had often looked at her in a sort of stupefied shock. Now they were still stupefied, but they were not so shocked, and often she made them laugh. And now they touched her, sometimes not even by explicit request. Pyrrha would roughly hug her in one big suddenness, or sweep Nona up in her hard, wiry arms before setting her down on the sofa. Palamedes would pull the blankets up over her if she was getting into bed and tuck them in softly at the corners. If she slipped her hand into Camilla's when they were walking down the street, Camilla would hold it. Nona didn't understand how the others could walk around and go through their lives only touching each other as much as was necessary. When Nona asked, Camilla said that this was because they needed to get the washing up done. Nona could do all the basic things now, but there was still distressingly little that she was good at. Nona was good at 1. Touching. 2. Wiping dishes. 3. Running her hand over the flat cork carpet in a way that got all the hair out of it. 4. Sleeping in lots of different ways and positions. And 5. Speaking any language that was spoken to her in person so she could see the person's face and eyes and lips. It turned out that Palamedes and Camilla could only speak one language, and Pyrrha could speak all of that one and some of another 2, and a little bit of about 5 more. The one language all 3 were fluent in was a kind people used for business transactions, so it wasn't strange that they used it, but it was falling out of favour because it was a language used by awful people. Even then, the dialect spoken in the city didn't always make sense to them, or the pronunciation was strange. Nona understood everybody and could speak back to them so that they understood her, and nobody ever said she had an accent. This confounded Palamedes. When she first said that she could speak back by watching them talk and making her lips look like theirs, it confounded him so much more that it gave Camilla a headache. There were lots of different languages and dialects around because of all the refugees from other planets, and because of all the resettlements. Nona knew about resettlements, because it was all anyone talked about in a queue, and if you spoke someone else's language, they were nicer to you, and assumed you had come from the same place they had come from, and lived through what they'd lived through, which was helpful. Many people were suspicious of other people because they wanted a good resettlement and were afraid that other people would somehow get them a bad resettlement. Many people had lived through at least one bad resettlement already. Everyone was crammed on one of 3 planets now, and they all agreed that this planet was easily the worst, though this always made Nona feel a little bit offended on the planet's part. And so Nona lived with Camilla, Palamedes and Pyrrha on the 30th floor of a building where nearly everyone was unhappy, in a city where nearly everyone was unhappy, on a world where everyone said you could outrun the zombies but not forever. You were not allowed to say the words zombies, necromancers or necromancy outside her house, or really inside it either. Nona said they talked about everything else, so why not those words? But Palamedes said superstition for the latter and indignation for the former, which Nona did not understand. This had been the case for Nona's entire life, which would be 6 months next week. And Pyrrha had said, as a treat, she would take everyone for a birthday trip to the beach, if nobody was setting up a mortar on it.
Nona was so grateful to have had a whole 6 months of this. It was greedy to expect much longer.
3.
Hardly anyone was suspicious of Nona, even in the early days. They assumed she was the way she was because she had been through something terrible. They had all known at least one person who had not been through something terrible. When she asked Camilla how she came across to other people, Camilla said, unworldly. Pyrrha said she acted like she had given away one of her 2 brain cells already. Pyrrha said to keep going, that people loved it if you were good-looking and dumb. Nona didn't want to be just good-looking and dumb. She wanted to be useful. She was dimly aware that she was not what anyone had wanted. This was why she had gone out and got herself a job, even though it wasn't a paying one. About 4 months in, when Nona had learnt enough to be allowed outside and to talk to strangers and to do up her own shirts, she was permitted to visit not merely the garage beneath the building, but the surrounding 3 buildings too. There was a school behind her building that used the first 2 floors of an old beat-up office block for classrooms, and Nona liked to hang around near the fence and watch the children play during break time. This caught the attention of a nice lady teacher, who asked Nona why she wasn't in school herself. She said truthfully enough that she did lessons at home, and the nice lady had made a face and asked Nona where she lived. When she heard that Nona lived in the building, she didn't quail, but wrote down the floor and apartment number on a piece of paper. When the nice lady teacher turned up one evening and told Pyrrha and Camilla how wonderful the school was and how it had almost 20 other children, and reading and writing at all the levels, and an hour of the sciences every day, and games, and talked about how it was even more important for children in the refuges to have a routine, so why didn't they want that for Nona? Cam had to tell the nice lady that Nona was nearly 19. The nice lady was totally foxed.
But she's such a dot.
Pyrrha explained without missing a beat that what with everything Nona had gone through, she had been ill and still didn't eat very much, which was why she was so knobbly and undergrown. The nice lady said that, yes, many of the children had problems like that, but it was still hard to imagine Nona was anywhere over 14, wasn't it? The nice lady added that she obviously didn't get her build from her father, and she smiled at Pyrrha. Before anyone could stop her, Nona laughed and laughed and said Pyrrha wasn't her father. The nice lady got suspicious. Nona could see it in her hands, and suggested that Nona should come anyway, could even be a teacher's aide, someone who helped the other children with their lessons. They told her Nona couldn't read or write, and the nice lady said, oh. But at this point, Nona felt the lure of not only an hour of the sciences every day and games, but also the glory suggested by the capitals of a teacher's aide, and she said,
I want to go, please and thank you.
The nice lady asked why didn't they try it out the next morning and see how it went. Nona was delighted. The lady said she was the main teacher, but they also had a wonderful science teacher, and it would be lovely to have someone else on the team. Their last teacher's aide had tragically died. Pyrrha said, were the kids that bad then? The teacher's mouth thinned and she said, no, the water plant explosion. And so Nona said, yes, she would go, before Camilla or especially Pyrrha could say anything else. Then Pyrrha, much to Camilla's disgust, flirted outrageously with the nice lady teacher until the nice lady teacher left. After Pyrrha saw the nice lady teacher out, Camilla, who had been pacing around the kitchen, looked up and said coolly, what was that? Getting us out of hot water, my naive beauty, said Pyrrha, collapsing into a chair with an appalling creak. She paid you and Junior the compliment of thinking you were working girls, and that I was your pimp. God knows I'd have had better luck pimping out Augustine and Alfred. Nona wanted to know, what's pimp? Instead of getting to know what pimp was, she got in trouble for giving anyone their door number and house number. Nona cried, lavishly and immediately, but Camilla and Pyrrha wouldn't budge. They also agreed that no way, no how was she going to school, not then and not ever. Camilla said it was too dangerous, and Pyrrha said it was a shame, but they were going to play it safe. Nona went to lie down on the bed and be angry. Then, much later on, when Nona was having her bath and Pyrrha was watching out for her, because back then there was still the danger that she'd have a funny turn and drown in 6 inches of water, Pyrrha said casually to Nona, "You're allowed to go to school for half days, on trial, and only as long as you practice answering questions with us first." Nona was ecstatic.
"Why? How? Truly?"
"Palamedes talked to me. Then he convinced Hecht."
"Oh, I love Palamedes," said Nona, and thus, fortified, dunked her head under the water, which she didn't like normally because she was mortally afraid of getting soap in her eyes.
When she emerged, spluttering, she had presence of mind to ask,
"Why did you flirt with the teacher, even though you didn't like her?"
Pyrrha's hands stilled from folding laundry, sitting next to the tub. "How do you know I didn't like her?" she asked. Nona still didn't have the words to explain.
"Just where you put your body. You only looked at her sometimes, that's all."
"Wish I'd had you in the bureau," said Pyrrha. But she didn't answer the question. That was why Nona was allowed to go to school, on the understanding that she would say she was living with her sister and a friend of her father's, and that everyone else was dead. This was an answer so ordinary and boring that she soon wished she had been given a more interesting one, for cultural cachet. Although Nona was officially a teacher's aide, she quickly learnt that she was really only interested in 3 parts of school. The first was games, the second was the hour of science, the third was the coloured markers that you could write on the squeaky whiteboards with and then rub off with a cloth so that you could mark again, which she was allowed to do to her heart's content. In fact, she only loved the hour of science because that was when she was allowed to look after Noodle, the science teacher's dog, who was a dirty white creature with 6 legs and a gentle disposition. She looked after Noodle while everyone else had to wrap ice cubes in socks, and the normal nice lady teacher, Jolie, marked books or drank big cups of hot tea. Then, during games, she watched to make sure nobody hit balls through any of the windows in the abandoned building next door. If they did, the ball was lost, because there were still mines and burnables all over. Neither of these duties was particularly hard, and she considered her lot a happy one. It was all unpaid, of course, but when she was at the dairy or talking to the people who weeded plants in the park, it was such fun to say, "I work at the school," when they asked her what she did. Everyone always said she was doing good work, and they couldn't ever even think of doing it themselves, but well done her. It was just as hard to make Nona learn any facts as it was to make her learn the sword or the bones. Harder, probably. As she explained all the time, as sweetly as she could, her brain simply wasn't interested in them. It was as though someone had probably told her everything before, and she had already forgotten it. Every lesson she sat in on, at a rickety desk with an old plastic chair at the back of a class full of kids, she could feel exiting her ears as soon as it entered them with the ring of old familiarity. It felt and sounded as though she had heard it all before. The teachers were amazed when they found out about her being able to speak all the languages, but Pyrrha had schooled her to say that she had had lots of resettlements, which seemed to suffice. The nice lady teacher abandoned trying to teach Nona, and instead treated her like a good simple colleague who could be relied upon to clean whiteboards and look after extraneous dogs and explain to the littlest children in a variety of languages where the bathroom was, which was really all teachers wanted. At school, after the first week, Nona was cornered by five children who informed her that she was now their friend.
Okay, said Nona.
Hot Sauce wants you, she got told.
Hot Sauce was the oldest child at 14, but she would have been the authority no matter her age. She was queenly for her years and spoke very seldom. She had burns on most of her body and had got to hold a gun in a war. If you were new to the school, her group always eventually found you and said,
"You have to come and see Hot Sauce,"
and took you to see Hot Sauce, and Hot Sauce would lift up her shirt and hoik up her shorts and show you the burns. This was intended to instill a sense of reverence in the fresh meat, not disgust, but the group was just as proud if the new child broke down crying or didn't want to look. Hot Sauce herself was blank and unmoving in her moods and did not seem to have many strong passions, except that she was violently disdainful of every subject but the hour of science. Nona wanted to know why Hot Sauce wanted her.
"You're old and can get us drugs," said Honesty,
who was 12 and served as Hot Sauce's lieutenant.
"You live in the building."
None of them was crestfallen when Nona told them she was not allowed to get anyone drugs. They took it with stoic acceptance.
"What's special about the building?" she asked.
"He's banned," said Honesty. "One of the other children," Beautiful Ruby said. "My mother says that if you get caught downtown or you shoot at the wrong window, you get taken to your building."
"But you play in the garage all the time," said Nona. "I've seen you. You were one of the ones who hit a car with one of the big hard balls and the alarm went off for 3 hours.
"Ah," said Beautiful Ruby wisely. "But that isn't in the building. That's the garage. You can see out through the strut, so it doesn't count as being in the building." "You need to show us the secret room where they keep the bodies after you're taken to the building and shot, or you can't be our friend anymore," said another child, born in the morning, who was the group's negotiator.
"I can't," said Nona, in agonies. "I only know the cupboard in my place where the hot water cylinder is."
The children got together and agreed that this was complete shit, not good enough and not up to expectations. But when they petitioned Hot Sauce, Hot Sauce simply said,
"She talks to the angel. She gets to look after Noodle."
The angel was what they called the nondescript, washed-out, dusty-haired personage who came to teach the hour of science. Why they called her the angel was unclear, but Hot Sauce idolised her. She was widely liked by all the children because she was calm and even-handed and the same day in and day out. But for Hot Sauce, and therefore the others, it was more like an obsession. Nona got to look after the science teacher's dog and knew its name and could report on how its fur felt, nice, and how its breath was, awful. She received such pearls from the science teacher's lips as, "Was Noodle a good boy for you today? Thank you, Nona," which made her an elevated personage. Facts about the angel were in short supply. Where the science teacher lived was a mystery, and Nona's hours were such that there was no way she could follow the science teacher home to see where home was or what she did there. Camilla came and picked Nona up every day after lunch, when school shut down in the afternoon heat and the hour of science happened before lunchtime. So, all in all, Nona's worth to the children was universally agreed to be minimal. She ranked very low among them, definitely below Honesty and Beautiful Ruby, and only fractionally higher than Born in the Morning. The only person Born in the Morning outranked was the 7-year-old, who was just Kevin. Those were really all their names, even Kevin. But nobody ever told Nona why Hot Sauce was called Hot Sauce. Hot Sauce had no parents, so she couldn't ask them. The other kids had 13 people at home between them, but the numbers were skewed by Born in the Morning, who was saddled with 5 fathers. Eldest father, second eldest father, younger brother father, and new father. More importantly to Nona, Beautiful Ruby had a new baby at home, and sometimes Ruby's mother brought the baby to the school foyer and she could look at the baby's fingernails, which were small. Nona explained all this to Camilla and to Pyrrha, and sometimes to Palamedes over dinners, usually in the hope that she could talk so much nobody would notice she wasn't using her mouth to eat. They all agreed that whatever made Nona happy at school made Nona happy at school, but the bottom line remained that she shouldn't buy anybody drugs.
"I don't," explained Nona. "Honesty found someone else to buy him drugs, so I don't have to."
"Is his name really and truly Honesty?" Palamedes wanted to know. Nona struggled.
"That's how I hear it. Anyway, he shouldn't be called Honesty at all. He tells huge lies and he's trying to teach me too."
Nona longed to lie, but didn't know how to stop her body from showing the truth. At first, she had triumphantly caught every one of Honesty's lies, until he took her behind the bike sheds and said he would give her a cigarette a week if she stopped. He was lying, but she could see how much it meant to him, so she stopped. And when she did get a cigarette, she slipped it to Pyrrha. Most of the best things she learnt from Pyrrha and Palamedes and Camilla, whom she loved and trusted with all her numbered days. But in those early times, when she wasn't used to living, the school children had taught her everything else. New words, mostly, which were always enlightening, but also how to spend time doing nothing. They made doing nothing an art, squatting on stoops or loitering in parks beneath splintering trees, running like crazy if they heard shots, running like crazy even if they didn't, so hard to keep up, hunkering beneath the roofs near the sanitation ponds, going where nobody cared if they went, fighting over scraps of shade near the huge cemetery hills, where they had dug all the bodies out of the cracked sand and concrete and put them in a huge pile, which still smelled terrible. One of their favourite ways to hide was to clamber up a dusty mound of rocks and rebar right at the very edge of their part of the city. They had to do this carefully because they could easily slice themselves open on a piece of rusty metal, and that meant Nona had to be doubly more careful than anyone and sit around on the second floor of a building that had been blown wide open to the sky. There was plenty of stained old office furniture to squat on, and they could watch the enormous stretch of road that ran all around the city. There was a huge expanse of it. Honesty said you could fit 20 vans on it at a time, and there used to be a train track in the middle with turn-offs and turn-offs for the turn-offs that led to a nest of tunnels beneath the city itself. In the tunnels, you could drive and drive and drive for hours and never see sunlight, said Honesty, but hardly anyone used them now. There were special fleets of gunners in cars that patrolled down there and shook people up for money or scavenged the cars that had never made their way out. Every so often, an absolutely enormous earthquake rumbled beneath them, and when Nona first asked what it was, Hot Sauce said,
"The convoy."
And because it was Hot Sauce and not Honesty, she knew it had to be true. How wonderful it sounded, the convoy, so big and mysterious and subterranean. Nona had no real idea of what a convoy was or what it looked like for a very long time, but she joined in with the others when they felt the rumble in the old office space hideout and competed to be the first to say, "The convoy," and have the others question or jeer or confirm.
"Can't feel it. That's a fart."
"No way, no way, that's right. That's the convoy, I can feel it, my shoes are off."
The whole broken building would rumble and shake, and at the end they would chorus, "Convoy gone!" Nona was frankly disappointed when she asked Pyrrha what a convoy was, when Pyrrha was half-absorbed in melting slag for dummy pellets in her little bullet-shaped crucible, and Pyrrha explained that it was a bunch of vehicles driving in a line, probably very big ones. But she never quite got over that little shake, that tight vibration of the stomach when the convoy was near, how it excited her somehow. It was like she could feel something wonderful in it. They often stayed in the abandoned office building until the glowering dusk, because nobody wanted that space or threw chunks of brick at them to make them leave. Nona loved to watch the moon tremble in front of the big broken hanging blueness in the sky, careless of it, while Honesty prized bullet casings out of holes in the walls and Kevin played with his dolls. Beautiful Ruby and Born in the Morning whiled away the time with a deck of playing cards that had too many numbers for Nona to join in. Sometimes Hot Sauce would play too, but mainly Hot Sauce silently and majestically held court as the city honked and smouldered and yelled. Nona liked to sit near Hot Sauce. It was good to be quiet. One time they were sitting there, and the convoy rumbled beneath them, with the others hooting and hollering, and Kevin putting his hands over his ears, patiently waiting for the convoy to go away. And when the last rumbles had died, Honesty looked over and said,
"You'll join Hot Sauce, won't you? Hot Sauce will join."
"Join what?" said Nona, the ignorant one, which made the others do their usual chorus of,
"Nona doesn't know. Nona doesn't know anything. Tell Nona."
And Honesty, who had been very nice since the cigarette arrangement, said,
"When we leave school, we're going to kill zombies. We're going to kill necromancers." "You shouldn't say the word," said Nona, forgetting in a panic that that was a Nona rule, not a school rule.
All Honesty did was drum his heels on the floor next to the wheelie chair that the stuffing was coming out of and exclaim,
"Who cares? I'm not scared. This isn't class. I can say what I want."
Born in the Morning said with an air of old rehearsal,
"I threw a rock at a necromancer and it died."
And Kevin crowed,
"No, you didn't. No, you didn't."
And Beautiful Ruby said,
"That's such a bullshit story you tell."
And Honesty easily and hypocritically said,
"You are such a liar, my man."
Born in the Morning protested,
"I did throw a rock and it did die."
And Nona said, "What, the rock?" At which the others paused in order to jeer at her. Then Beautiful Ruby explained that the rock had been thrown at one of the cages, and the necromancer had been almost all the way on fire, and the question of whether or not the rock had even hit the necromancer or the bars was still a live one. But the rock could have helped. A rock hits you in the head, you're going to die, aren't you? While the others litigated whether or not the rock still counted if the necromancer was almost all the way on fire, Hot Sauce, sitting with her legs dangling over the side of the broken floor, had gone very still. Nona always noticed when Hot Sauce was still, because her stillness was peculiar. It wasn't the stillness others got when they were thinking about things in class. Marker paused as their brains furiously combed over some answer. It was the stillness of someone rejecting thinking. Mid-argument, Ruby's voice rose over the others.
"There aren't any necromancers here anymore. They're all dead."
Bourne said,
"Not all of them. My dad says they're all in the barracks."
"Which dad? You have like 70.
"Don't say I have like 70. You know how many dads I got."
"If I had the amount of dads you got, I'd sell some of them," said Ruby.
"You think you would, but you wouldn't," said Bourne wisely.
Honesty said,
"Some of the zombies go spying outside the barracks. They ain't all mad. That's why you got to make sure you see all your friends eating and bleeding, or you know, bam, you're dead, or bones, or worse."
"I eat," protested Nona.
"Nobody's saying you're a zombie, you dumbass," said Honesty. "I'm saying hidden zombies, you know, spies. You're pretty stupid for your age, you know that."
"I watched Nona eat a pebble,"
Kevin volunteered, bending one of his doll's legs into position. Then,
"And a marker top."
"Don't squeal, Kevin," said Nona, offended and on her dignity. She had just learnt squeal and therefore used it constantly.
"And Honesty, don't call me a dumbass. At home they said if you called me a dumbass again, I should tell you that they know what you look like and they'll beat you up."
"Okay, I don't want to piss off your folks who live with a pimp," said Honesty.
By that point, Nona knew what pimp was and was so annoyed she knew she was on the road to a tantrum. But before intra-group violence could erupt or get contracted out, Hot Sauce raised her voice and said,
"The necromancers will come back. They may already be here."
Everyone subsided into reverent silence at Hot Sauce's proclamation, even Nona, who took the opportunity to do 5 breaths in and out like Camilla had shown her. Eventually, beautiful Ruby broke the silence and said,
"What about Varun, Hot Sauce? What about Varun the Eater?"
"It's here for them," said Hot Sauce.
They looked up through the big crack at the blued sky respectfully. Then Honesty said,
"You'll join up, right, Hot Sauce? You're going to go over."
But Hot Sauce didn't answer. And then Kevin wanted to go to the bathroom, so they had to call out, "Not me," to see who had to escort Kevin to the bathroom. He was a big boy and easily old enough to go to the bathroom by himself. But Kevin had such a huge facility for freaking out and locking himself in places that you had to wait until he'd finished peeing to make sure you didn't need to bust a door lock open with half a brick. By the time that had been agreed on, they concluded Ruby had said, "Not me," last. The question had been dropped. And there was Hot Sauce, very still and looking at the sky. Nona whispered,
"Join what, Hot Sauce?"
Hot Sauce didn't answer her. When she did say anything, she asked a question instead, which was irritatingly like Pyrrha.
"You like it here?"
"I love it here," said Nona sincerely.
"I wouldn't want to be anywhere else."
"You're sweet," said Hot Sauce. That settled it. Nona knew. If Hot Sauce thought Nona was sweet, she was going to be part of the group no matter what. From that day, nobody bothered to question Nona's presence, no matter what she said, or how old she was, or how little facility she had for buying anyone drugs. She was one of them, which gave her enormous pleasure. She was born to the untold wealth of belonging to Camilla and Pyrrha and Palamedes, and now added the beauty of being friends with Hot Sauce and Hot Sauce's friends, which gave her high status in the world, even considering Kevin. She loved Camilla and Pyrrha and Palamedes, but the thing about being with Hot Sauce and the others was that you could be completely and entirely alone. Eventually, when it got dark enough, all their families would come looking for them. Cam always came horribly early, except for Hot Sauce, who had nobody to come looking for her, and Honesty, whom nobody ever remembered about. But even with this flaw in paradise, Nona could do nothing but hug her knees to her chest and feel fantastically, wonderfully lucky, luckier than anyone else who had ever had the pleasure of being born.
4.
The morning routine was that they would walk together until Pyrrha had to split off, and then Cam would drop Nona off at school and go off to do her own thing, clean the house or do crimes that Nona wasn't allowed to partake in. Nona liked the walk, but the early morning was as cold as the afternoon was hot, so to keep warm she had to stamp her feet and put her hands in her pockets. They walked alongside all the other workers, the ones who didn't get picked up in the morning in the worker vans, or didn't have a job that merited a worker van, or didn't have a job but lived in hope, and they all trudged slowly through the street in clusters, parting only when a truck ground through, the driver leaning on the horn if someone didn't move out of the way quick enough. Nona's breath was misting on the inside of her mask and escaping out its cracks in ghostly grey puffs by the time they made it to the park, comfortable but not talking. It was always the same route, straight down the street all the way to the gates of the thing that had used to be the big park, and then Pyrrha would say something like, "Let's cut through, it's so smoky," or she'd say, "Let's not, park